there's this, even in, you know, we have these notions of things that we call Western that are by no means Western. And you had mentioned the six-pointed star, which I saw all over India, which we've adopted and we associate with Judaism, which even in Judaism, that's, I mean, is how Western is that, you know? So basically, when you're talking about as above, so below, but I would say that even with the Tanakh, and like you have the book of Ezekiel, whom we refer to as a prophet, yet there's very little like fortune telling in that. It's more like a kind of like appearing to the wiring under the board. Here's something that's just completely archetypal, and what might appear to many as nonsensical, but has esoteric implications to be derived from it that are still purposefully, as far as I can tell, open to interpretation. And so,
and I think it's a very good clarification. You know, I think you're absolutely right. And when I say Western, I think what I meant not that the text is Western in origin, but that it is part of our common worldview in the West. That's all I meant. But you're correct. Many of these things don't have origins. I mean, in the West, many of the things that have become part and parcel of the Western psyche had origins elsewhere. That's a really good clarification.
Also, it's just incredible the degree of the amount of attention that's been put on keeping these things, a lot of these different philosophies and what are taken as religions to be questioned or explored in a free thinking way. There's an incredible value to approaching any of this on that level. And like, there's certain things that show up that aren't easily reconciled in terms of meaning. Like I saw an image you're probably familiar with of where they lay out the way that the game was played with, I believe it was a rubber ball that they would hit on
yeah.
the chest and get through this little hoop. It looks like kind of like basketball. Mm-hmm. Where
basketball with E.
Where there's
it was just an E.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I said that it's basketball with your knee.
Oh, with your knee. They would hit it with
the... You have to get the ball through the little ring with your knee.
Wow. Okay. Where they show what happened to the winner and that the winner would get their head cut off and how... is that correct?
That's a great example. Well, it's a great example of what we were talking about before about the use of situation and perspective vis-a-vis truth. Like when I was talking about Newton and the apple falling, and that's true in our sort of three-dimensional world where we walk and where we talk on the internet and all that. But once we get to the very big level of Einstein or the very small level of Niels Bohr, it no longer is as true. By the same token, the game has different manifestations. Okay, the game was something that the Mayans used for various purposes, not a huge number, but a set of several purposes on a regular basis. One of which was what you described, namely the winner gets to die. That was a situation where if someone had done something particularly profound, they be given the opportunity for some kind of reward, and they might choose the game with the idea that if they won the game, they would then be executed. Now, why is that a reward? Because in the Mayan worldview, death is, they have a quite healthy, or at least they did, I don't know so much about now, but things are a little bit grayer now, but culturally at least they have a very different view of death because of the cyclical view that they have about time in the world. The winner would be executed in order to be able to pass to the next level, the next kind of circle and pile, the next step up with the ancestors and maybe some lower deities or that kind of thing. So that would be a reward. By the same token, the game was also used as a punishment. The game would be used to adjudicate. So if you and your friend have a conflict and there's no resolution to it, you might come to the elder, the warlord, and petition a case, and the decision might be brought that this would be adjudicated in the game, and that the loser or the losing team, because the game was both a solo event and also a team event, would then be killed. So death could be a good thing for the virtuous, for the morally profound, and for the small, the shallow, the selfish, it could also be used as a punishment. The game was also used to adjudicate politics, land. What am I talking about? Land grants, things like that. So the game was very central, and that's why when you go to these cities, you'll see the ball court is always right in the most important area where all the most important things are going on is the ball every time. So to them, the game was much more important than any game. Any sporting event we have now, way more important than baseball or football or tennis, whatever. Very, very central to the life there. And that does get back to what you were saying before about play and the prophets and our willingness to talk and to publish our thoughts on esoteric things and to call into question certain dogmas and to bandy about different ideas and different possibilities. And yes, it is all play and it is all exploration. And I believe it was Einstein who said that he had his E equals MC squared eureka moment in the shower when he was, you know, he'd already given up on it or whatever.
I believe he was masturbating at the time.
Yeah.
So the way that I saw the winner represented, or I guess you're saying in some cases the loser, was with his head being chopped off. In the imagery, it actually showed serpents coming out from his neck where his head would have been, which I really like kind of struck me. And I thought about that. I saw that years ago and it left an impact, that image. And so, I mean, and I personally can't help but see a correlation between that and kind of like the tantric idea of the Kundalini force being represented as a serpent. This idea that the serpent is in the body and then with the death, the serpent is being let out and going in these directions was just so that's obviously open to interpretation. Yet at the same time, there's a plain picture there. I'm looking at a body with a head removed with serpents coming out. You know, it's like that's... You know,
I like that as well, because what you've hit on again here is one of these things that is really universal. I talked about cyclical time before as being a Native American thing, and they also have it in parts of Asia, but it's certainly not European, whereas this concept is completely universal. Okay, and to me, my interpretation of that is simply the divinity within us, right, which can be a positive force, or it could be a negative force. So think of angels and demons in the Christian tradition, possession, visitation. But really, ultimately, what it boils down to in the most, to take a vast array of complexities and reduce it to utter simplicity, is the notion of divine energies within us.
Yes.
That's my interpretation of it.
Sure. Yeah, I had a ayahuascan vision of serpents embedded in my body that were essentially pure, but had like taken in the toxins or whatever you want to call it. It had pulled in into themselves and were kind of like nestled in the nooks and crannies of my being, and that the ayahuasca being introduced was like something the medicine was literally tugging at the serpents and pulling them out from their hiding places to be renewed and let out. And so personally, I couldn't help but see like a correlation between the idea of how snot in the body when it's first produced is perfectly clear and pure, and that as it descends into your body with a cold, it pulls in the toxins and then comes back up. You know, I looked at the divinity in ourselves as that. It's just, I mean, so. But what was interesting is that...
Wait, I got to stop you right there.
Sure.
So snot is the divinity.
Sure. Well, that it starts out...
Just had to jump on.
Yeah, no, totally. That it's something that's pure, and then it pulls in to itself in order to, you know, renew one. So it's just that I couldn't help but find a correspondence there, and it seemed to make sense. Because people don't usually think of snot that way. Like, usually you think of snot, you think of green, slimy shit. And it's like, no, actually, snot is a very clean and pure thing initially until it descends. And so I couldn't help but see the, the spiritual serpents through that lens. It's kind of far out, but whatever.
It's also interesting because, you know, here we have ayahuasca, which I believe is originally an Amazonian thing, but we're talking about the Mayans, and of all the Native Americans that I've encountered, most of which, not all, but most of which engage in some kind of psychotropic activity as part of spiritual evolution, the Mayans are by far the most interested in that, and had various again, mostly lost because all those books were destroyed, but had various methodologies for various purposes. And they would use different cocktails of psychoactive plant matter for those purposes. Usually, if you're talking about a higher level shaman, usually delivered via enema.
Oh, wow.
If you ever go to a Mayan, if you go to Tikal or Chichen Itza or any of the big Mayan sites, they'll have a gift shop there. And in that gift shop, there'll be these bones. They're hollow bones, and they have carved on them various art pieces. And really what those are depicting are your guardians and guides to the, some would say the underworld, but I'll just say to another world, another universe, where you're going to beseech the ancestors and the deities for help or whatever it is you need, or whatever it is the purpose of your voyage. And so what it would do is put this cocktail of plant matter. It might include psilocybin, it might include various cacti or whatever, and it might include many things that we don't even know about because they were destroyed with the books. A certain cocktail for a certain purpose for a certain moment, and that would be ground up into a fine powder, put into this bone that would then be inserted into the traveler's rectum, and then blowgunned up into their lower intestine, thereby increasing the effect.
Yeah.
In the most general sense, the purpose for that really is a voyage. And that's why on those bones you will see boats and a direction. Everybody's moving usually from right to left on those bones. And that's because you're taking a voyage and you're a voyage to contact ancestors and the deities, if possible. And in the Mayan hierarchy of metaphysic, I'm going to forget right now. Are there 13 levels? I may be wrong about that, but there are a number of levels, and I believe we are on the second level. Hmm. Below us would be the plants and the single cell, the amoebas and the nonsense life, And there's sentient life, so we're on the same level as the cats and other animals that are conscious. And then the next level up from us are the ancestors, and there is some overlap. According to what I learned, there might be some lower deities that might also be on that next level up from us. And then when you get above that, and then when you get above that, then you're getting into higher level deities that usually do not interact with us. And if they are interacting with us, it's going to be ugly. Hmm. Basically, they don't want to be bothered. That's why there's the level of ancestors and lower deities between them and us. So if they're forced to sort of stop their business meeting to deal with some stupid little
yeah, they're busy with bigger work.
Yeah, they got things to do, and this is another way where our Western mindset differs, right? Because especially in Christianity, there's this notion of emulating Jesus, and each individual is just as important, and all that can be very beautiful. It can also be, as we know from things that have been done in the name of religion, very ugly. But the point I'm making is, in the Mayan worldview, we're important, but everything's important, but we're on an evolutionary journey. Okay, so eventually you go to the ancestral level, and there you're going to continue your work. You're not in heaven. You're not stopping. You're not going to, just sit there and have a good time. You have whatever work there is to do there to evolve higher. And eventually, I guess if you took it to its extreme, one would become pure energy at the end, right? At the very top is the sort of monotheistic concept of a great energy that is the center of all. And the minds do have that concept, but that is at the very, very top, another light, pure energy, and then you become one with everything, I guess. But that would take many, many eons of good Boy Scout work and earning many merit badges. This I the reason I throw that in is there's a dark side to the Mayan. I wanted to get back to that. I had mentioned this romanticism that's put on it. And for good reason. I mean, there's nothing more romantic to me. I mean, this is why I spent, initially why I got so fascinated with it when I went to Tikal for the first time in 1996, and I'm sitting on top of this pyramid that's glowing in the moonlight. I managed to stay in the archaeological site after sundown. I wasn't supposed to do that, but I figured out a way to do that. And I was on top of pyramid number 4, and it started glowing in the moonlight. And I was looking out over the jungle, and it was just unbelievably romantic. And that got me interested in it. And then as I learned more and more and more about it, and then you begin to learn that it really isn't so romantic after all. They are interested in the same way as the West or the East with maintaining order in society. And I believe that that's where, although I can't get confirmation from it because I'm not allowed to get past the absolute most basic information because of the secrecy and the hierarchy involved in the shamanic order. But I believe that the shamanic order was something that was put in place to control the society. And so there is a dark side to it. And it was also very brutal because the virtuous, according to their value system, did not fear death. There are many, many brutal things that went on. I mean, it's much uglier than people realize, and it's certainly not a society I would want to live in.
Would you say that it got progressively more in that direction as time went on, or do you know about that? Sorry to interrupt.
No, they have a here. It's interesting because if you look at the cyclical time. Okay, what that does is that tells you you don't need to be a hero. What I was talking about before about wisdom being the ability to understand the cycles as they happen, whether it's a small cycle, a medium cycle, or a big cycle, and that's wherein lies wisdom, right? Not in performing great deeds or being a great person, but in simply understanding how the world works. Okay, so that's kind of like the light side. The dark side is a kind of hero worship that they had. where these cities were city-states founded by individual men. So you would have powerful men who were gifted in whatever manner, usually in political or leadership ability and military ability. A great example is Copan, and God, what was his name? Yakushmo, I believe, was his name. Mexico, southern Mexico, Chiapas. He came east and south to an unclaimed territory and founded Copan. And he brought a lot of people with him. I mean, so there were heroes who would then get followers, almost in a cult sense, but not quite so culty as Sun Myung-moon or Ron Hubbard or like that, which tends to be much more kind of a religion, what you would have is a mix of that with like a Julius Caesar. So, you know, Joseph Smith, mix him with a Julius Caesar, that kind of person.
Okay.
And you know, they would have all these followers, and then they would go and they would set up their cities. So one must remember that the Mayan culture, like the Greeks, they're very much like the Greeks in a sense, they were city-states, and each one of them had its own independence, and they had to fight each other to gain more power or to protect themselves or what have you. So there is a very dark side to it, and I don't know if that addresses your question enough.
No, sure, yeah. Yeah, well, I think more what I was asking was if you think that in terms of, because I know that there's this notion of sacrifice, which we were talking about the game obviously earlier and whatnot, but I know that was it more true with the Aztecs? And what was the, like, do you know, have an idea of like,
what you were asking. Okay.
Time progression of the violent side of that.
So what happened with the Mayans is, so what I'm saying is there was a violent side to it all along. Mm-hmm. Then what you had is you had the collapse that happened in the 800 to 900, year period of our, Anno Domini calendar, our Gregorian calendar. Which is a fascinating subject in and of itself. But then they kind of dispersed and they left these cities like Tikal and Copan, which are more in the south, right? These are places in Guatemala. They left them and they basically disappeared. Some of them set up new cities, but never as big or as majestic as the ones before, until later. Then you start seeing things like Chichen Itza and Palenque coming into being, which existed at the moment the conquistadors arrived. So there's a common misconception that the Mayans collapsed and were gone. That's not true. They collapsed. They were always there. They collapsed, but they went back into the woods, many of them. Some of them migrated. They figured they had it all wrong because their society collapsed, right? So they kind of went back to the drawing board. And then what you see several hundred years later, the beginnings again of this warlord culture. And then it was more. So you're correct in the sense that later on it became more brutal. However, it was brutal all along. In terms of sacrifice, there's a notion that we see wherever there's sacrifice involved in Native American culture, which gets back to this sense of the positive and the negative, the light side and the dark side. Okay, so the light side is the benevolent, protecting side. And the dark side is the devouring, death-causing, disease-causing, destructive force. You might reduce it to a creative force and a destructive force. The destructive force has this tremendous appetite to destroy. So in order to keep the destructive force at bay, you feed it. Because if you feed it, then it's less hungry. So it's less likely to ruin everything. So There was, and there's not a whole lot of, you know, you really have to go to Dr. Smith, the sort of premier Mayan scholar. He would probably know more about it, but it's all really very new because there's so little writing, you know, it has to be uncovered on the very many cities that are being excavated all the time in carvings on the buildings. We have to learn more from the carvings on the buildings because we don't have the books. But the feeding of the destructive force, it seems, increased with the increase in uncertainty and calamity. Okay, so it would stand to reason, and there's some evidence to back this up, that in the south, where the collapse happened first, places like Copan and Tikal, when the seven-year drought hit, before they figured out that they just had it all wrong and they had to go back to the drawing board and they went back into the forest or what have you, in the first few years of it, they probably increased the amount of sacrifice, the type of sacrifice, and the quality of sacrifice. So the highest quality of sacrifice, of course, the human sacrifice, because we were so enamored of how great we are. That is universal, too. So the highest form of sacrifice there would be human. So it would stand to reason that as there was more calamity, there would be more human sacrifice. There's a lot of debate on how this happened. But in the most general sense, there seems to be agreement that that did happen. And that is not a result, I think, of an increase in the overall brutality of the culture as much as it is more likely an attempt by the culture to keep the dark forces at bay by, you know, satisfying their hunger.
That's interesting. I'd read something on the Book of Job where it says that it was him not feeding the klipot properly, the outside forces, giving them their food, basically. He didn't sacrifice to them enough, and that was why he was basically too perfect. Or if you try and like ignore the dark side too much, that's when the dark side takes over, which is kind of like an idea of repression, right? That if you repress a force too much, it's going to do its thing anyway, so you might as well do it consciously. Which, you know, in certain ways, I don't know how true that ultimately is, if that's just a superstition, but I think that there is something to be said for that rationale of you know, in terms of repression. You just go ahead and you do it.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for that. Yes, and I was going to bring up Freud. You brought up repression, so Freud has the concept of libido, and many people forget thanatos. There's the will to life, which is libido, and there's the will to death, thanatos.
Right.
So you know, I wonder with Freud, because you know he was such a brilliant man, and he had been doing anthropological research on his own, you know, and just putting new names on these things.
Yeah.
Or digesting them and spewing them back in a way that was more palatable to the people of his society and age.
Right. Well, they're archetypal too. And so there's always that argument that if something's just true, you're going to come across it wherever you're looking. And that's one reason why you'll find universally us expressing things in the very same archetypes. But then at the same time, you have like Jung is just saying outright, this is where I got this, which I wondered to myself before if that was actually Freud's beef with Jung was not that he was looking at the mysticism, but he was actually telling the public where he was getting the ideas, you know.
That could be. That would make an interesting doctoral dissertation. You know, I was always taught that the beef came because Jung said, we're basically doing philosophy and anthropology here. And Freud said, no, we're doing truth.
Right.
In other words, Freud's ego is, you know, way too big for
So when you were talking about the multiple calendars and the way that they're connected and the level of complexity to which they connect, that is something that calls to mind what is ultimately the basis of or what's emphasized with our show is synchronicity. And so for them to put those calendars out there in the way that they did, and for the amount of connections to occur, it seems as though that would be an example of where there's an inherent complexity that's like, if you set up a certain amount, this is hard to explain, but if you set up a certain amount of parameters that have enough like archetypal connections, that they will literally build and build beyond even the scope of the people who laid them out in the first place. In other words, you set up the pieces knowing that they will just lead to further and further connections that basically extend into eternity, which sounds kind of far out. But I haven't studied it like you have, but that's how when that's been said to me about the calendars, I can't help but consider it in that way. Does that make any sense?
I think that it makes total sense. And I always come back to the butterfly effect. When thinking about the Mayan worldview, particularly, I always come back to the butterfly effect. You're familiar with that?
Sure.
From fractal mathematics. Okay. So in the Mayan worldview, exactly what you said is the case, because their worldview is all about synchronicity. And so to morality, very much like, to get really start jumping all over the place, but maybe it'll be entertaining, I hope, for your listeners, the Buddhist concept as well, right? So the Mayans really, in their morality, believed in right thought and right action because of the synchronicity factor in terms of the butterfly effect. So according to the Mayan worldview, whatever you think and do here could have profound effects all the way across the galaxy. Oh, and definitely they were all about there's other life out there. Oh, yeah. But, so whatever you're doing here and thinking at this moment may having profound effects on some world, hundreds of thousands of light years away. And so it is synchronicity taken to a universal level. That and also on a personal level, right? Because you take what you have to offer, and you go to the plaza and you find the priest that you like or the one that's free, and you ask for wisdom for the day, and that priest interprets the 19 intersecting levels, also interpreting based on your name and what day it is in terms of what time we are in the year and all this kind of stuff. It all interacts when you were born and gives you an interpretation of the synchronicity of the day and what its significance is. So they were all about synchronicity way before Jung.
Right. Well, most it seems if you go far enough into the esoteric side of most cultures, you end up finding more of an emphasis on synchronicity than just about anything. As far as I can tell, it's like the basis of mysticism since its very beginning. Just to find two or more pieces, archetypal pieces, and then extrapolating information from how they correspond. That idea of correspondence is something that you find everywhere, which is why the show and the community we're connected to is just compulsively obsessed with the idea of correspondence. And
isn't all synchronicity born from a hunter's and a gatherer's mindset? Is that if you're dropped in the middle of a nature setting, how do you track animals or how do you find edible plants? I mean, the things that work and the things that don't work seem to announce themselves through how we still experience synchronicity. So I'm thinking of a civilization that's obsessed with synchronicity. Is that why they did not keep domesticated animals? That they still maintained hunting and gathering as a way to keep the mind in that mindset?
I think I think that is partially correct, yes. But the thing with the Mayans, since we're talking about the Mayans, but I'd be happy to talk about the Aymara as well here. But anyway, the Mayans were absolutely obsessed with agriculture. Corn. Everything is to them is corn. But at the same time, they have the hunter-gatherer background. Okay, that got folded into their religion. And what they wanted to do is liken themselves to the jaguar, for example, right? So the jaguar does not go and hunt indiscriminately. The jaguar hunts when it needs to hunt, and it takes out the weak and the sick, you know, to improve the overall quality of life for everyone. So the Mayans... didn't domesticate animals, in my opinion, because of their respect for animals. They really put the animals on the same level as us. So, they did it out of respect. They did fish a bit more than they hunted, but they hunted. But when they hunted, they tried to be like the jaguar, and it was also a like everything else they were doing, a hierarchical thing, right? So as a, you know, as a 16-year-old or whatever, you're not like going out and hunting necessarily. Maybe you are, but they were much more obsessed on a daily basis with the scarcity of hybridization of corn. So if you're in the right place at the right time with the two different strains of corn and you put them together, voila, you got magic.
Right. Bill, tell Alex about your blog name. I think it's applicable.
Oh, I'll type it in there. I refer to it as, it's a play on ayahuasca, but with the lowercase I of, the iPod, the iPhone.
Ayahuasca.
And what it kind of relates to.
Oh, not all these messages. I didn't realize you were sending me messages. Now I see them. I missed them all. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. That's fine. But, you know, what it speaks to is that we continue to do this trial and error and synchronistic hunt in all phases of our life. It's just a matter of how aware you are of it. And I think that we've discussed on the show many times is that it can start off as a very entertaining and funny and exciting kind of endeavor, but then you get into different terrains which can make it darker, conspiratorial, and takes you on a pretty crazy adventure, which I think is designed to teach about self, because we are embedded in this universe. We are carrying the weight of everything around us, and this is sort of the tool to I don't know, it's the Doubting Thomas tool, you know, to actually touch and feel the body of the mystery. So it's good to know from you I didn't know as explicitly in the way the terms are being discussed today that, you know, this is a very big part of the foundation of Mayan culture.
Oh, yeah. And so look at the agriculture, particularly corn, right? That was their big deal. As an evolution of the hunt. It's not a different thing. See, in Western, you know, we've got Cain and Abel, right? They're separated.
Yep.
They're two different things. Okay, but in the Mayan thing, the agriculture is just the hunt taken to the gathering, taken, you know, evolved through right action and right thought and synchronicity to a reward, namely better strains of corn. And so it's no different in that sense from the hunt.
Well, so when you look at the Torah and when Cain and Abel are introduced, it's laid out in a very specific way where you have the introduction of the duel of duality is followed immediately by Cain and Abel, meaning that that's the first thing to emerge that creates a conflict out of the duality is between agriculture and meat. And so that's very, very strategically presented in that text.
It is. And what I was going to say to Bill as well, though, you said something about how it can get very dark when we research, when we begin our research to esoterica, and we begin discovering things, it can get very dark. You said something like that. And I wanted to say, yes, I agree with that. But I also, what I'm finding is that ultimately it also can be very light, because let me share with you a brief story. Now, this is just interpretation, okay? And you could interpret this in any way you wish, including that I'm completely out of my mind. But the other day, okay, I was in this little village high up in the Andes, and I had a hostel there, and I went out, and I forget what I was doing. I was out after dark, and I came back to the hostel at like 10:30 at night, and the place was completely locked and shut, and lights were out, and, you know, it took me half an hour pounding on the door before they opened the door. And this 14-year-old kid opens the door, and I'm like, you know, how is it possible that you have a hotel that is completely shut down at 10:30 at night? I mean, this isn't two in the morning. You know, and I was irritated. I was pretty pissed off, actually. So the poor kid, you know? And what it was it was a cultural mismatch, right? Because he assumes I understand how things are done, and I assume he understands how things are done, right? So, but I have a lot of experience in travel, and I felt some, you know, I felt bad about it. So I spent the whole next day trying to figure out what the significance of this was. And at the moment I was doing that, I lost all my photos of the previous day. Gone. And that's a whole other, basically the energies of the place confounded my high-tech device, and that combined with my own stupidity and my lack of acclimatization to the altitude resulted in loss of all these photos. But then I was sitting there going like, okay, first I was good about that. I let that go. But then I was sitting there thinking there must be a greater significance to this. What is it? And then I came up with this reminder to myself, because I used to be like this, and I try not to be like this, but every once in a while I am, which is when we try to soak up as much of the experience as possible and in a sense own it. And part of that's good, which is an internalization of new things and foreign things and all that. But part of also dark, which is in that sense of owning it, kind of like a bucket list type thing. It's like, oh, I did that. I got that. I know that. I own it. And that's where I should know better. Speaking of knowing and owning, I should own a better knowledge than that. So what I did is then I went back to the hotel, and I sat with the hotel and his family, including the boy, and we had a long talk about cultural interchange, where using this moment of very minor, you know, irritation and not really even conflict, but a kind of minor unpleasant moment as a starting point for investigating a greater significance. And the end result of that was a really beautiful thing where I had this interchange with this man who said, oh, I see. So when the tourists come, it would be a good idea for me to look at the sky and tell them when it's going to rain. And I said, yeah. And they'll respect you for it, because they'll say, how did that guy know it was going to rain at 2 in the afternoon? Whereas for them, you know, for them, that's like they take that for granted, the way we take for granted that the light is going to be on in the hotel at 30 at night. You know, they just know these things that we don't know. And so there was this amazing interchange. And then what I found out was, okay, the end result of that conversation, very positive. And then I went out and had a nice evening. And then the next day, I found that everywhere I went in the town, everyone knew who I was, and they were all smiling at me, and they were all so happy to see me. It was just amazing. And that's because I was talking about ways with that hotel owner where they could have tourism without having it turn into a Cuzco, or for that matter, a Puno, where I am right now. And the reason I'm here right now is it's kind of like convenient, and it's also a place where I can get internet connection and talk to you, but it's also a convenient sort of central spot. But so many places have been ruined, particularly Cuzco, by tourism, and the wrong kind of tourism, where they've just sort of carte blanche said, okay, we'll get money out of them, we'll let them run amok, we'll let them own a place, and we'll get rich doing it. And this place where I was, Chivay, they don't want to do that. They want to hold on to their culture. And so what they've done is they've completely controlled that town and the canyon that's connected to it, so that you have to pay to get in, even to the area. You have to pay to get in. And they control what you're allowed to do and so on, which is the other extreme, which isn't good either. So I'm talking to him about how can you have a balance between having this place and interchanging with people, not just money, but knowledge, without be rude. As a result of that, this thing that happened where first I got pissed off at the kid, then I lost my photos, turned into this really positive experience that I'll, you know, in my heart the rest of my life. By the end, that boy Gustavo loves me, man. I'm like, you know, his new best friend, and all the people in the family in the hotel, they all love me, and I gave them gifts and they gave me stuff, and then all the people in the town knew me and liked me, and they're all telling me to come back and all this kind of stuff. So the reason I bring that up is that's a very simple example of taking the synchronicity one level more, because we have to live in a we don't have to. I have to, and I would hope that other people would strive to live some kind of morality. Now, morality has become a bad word because it's associated with the control of our lives by religion. I don't think that's what it is. I'm talking about making choices where we pick a direction that we want to go in. Okay, so if I want to go in the direction of positive, of benevolence, of protection, of health, of light, of smile, happiness. How do I do that? I do that each time I make a choice. And also, if I make a bad choice, how do I handle that? And in that sense, what we can do is we can take synchronicity and use it as a touchstone for our choices about what kind of world we want to live in.
Sure.
So that's my little anecdote there from the other day.
Yeah, I dig it. It's like the that applies to the idea of infinite recursion as well, in terms of an inertia that extends into the future, and that we will continue to make the same mistakes unless if there's a directional force that's outside of our personal level of cause and effect, right? So we just like react to life situations the same way, no matter how many times. It's just one of the, and like, that's the idea of hell, right? Hell, if anything, is repetition. It's the idea that you introduce a new factor that is strong enough to, even though this is how one would be expected to react, especially within oneself, but actually show